Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk Wyoming. I'm Mark Hamilton, your host, and today we'll be taking a look at our Wyoming weather. We'll also talk about Paul Harvey and the rest of the story. And finally, we'll look at Calamity Jane, a character in the past of Wyoming. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the show. Taking a look at Wyoming weather, and it's been shared by everybody in the country. I've never seen a weather pattern like we've had. We've got finally going to break out of it. It looks like the temperature started to moderate yesterday, but we did have some unbelievable weather. I think the lowest temperature I saw here in Thermopolis, Wyoming was 28 below. Might hit 30 one morning briefly, but it just didn't let up. And one thing I can say, we were lucky we didn't have a lot of wind, which was the saving grace. Now, up in Montana, I saw some wind chill at 65 below. I used to live years ago in Cutbank, Montana. And there's a sign when you come into Cutbank about being the coldest place in the United States. And I don't know. I think I would give Chinook, Montana the coldest. But it is definitely a cold snap that hit that we probably... we're never prepared for it. We're used to them, and we've had them before, but we don't like them. But it is breaking. Looks like the temperatures are going to moderate. And hey, man, it's one day closer to spring. I hope everyone is having a good start to 2024. A lot of things, as we always talk about, are happening in our world. Every day we turn and see something new that is taking place, and it is a little bit perilous now. I got a bill yesterday for my auto insurance, and it has gone through the roof. I also got another bill for an organization that I volunteer for their insurance. It went up $150 a month, and every time you look at these increases, it's really tough outside. Being older, I grew up listening every day at lunch hour to Paul Harvey, and a lot of people remember Paul Harvey, and I want to read this transcript from Paul Harvey from 1965, and it was Paul Harvey's If I Were the Devil. If I were the devil, if I were the prince of darkness, I want to engulf the whole wide world in darkness, and I'd have a third of it real estate and four-fifths of it population. But I wouldn't be happy until I seized the ripest apple on the tree, thee. So I'd set about, however necessary, to take over the United States. I'd subvert the churches first. I'd begin with a campaign of whispers, with wisdom of a serpent. I would whisper to you as I whisper to Eve, do as you please. To the young, I would whisper that the Bible is a myth. I would convince them that man created God instead of the other way around. I would confide that what's bad is good and what is good is square. And the old I would teach to pray after me, our Father, which art in Washington. And then I'd get organized. I'd educate authors in how to make the lurid literature exciting so that anything else would appear dull and uninteresting. I'd threaten TV with dirtier movies and vice versa. I'd peddle narcotics to whom I could. I'd sell alcohol to ladies and gentlemen of distinction. I'd tranquilize the rest with pills. If I were the devil, I'd soon have families that war with themselves, churches at war with themselves, and nations at war with themselves, until each in its turn was consumed. And with promises of higher ratings, I'd have mesmerizing media fanning the flames. If I were the devil, I would encourage schools to refine young intellects but neglect to discipline emotions. Just let them run wild until, before you knew it, you'd have to have drug-sniffing dogs and metal detectors at every schoolhouse door. Within a decade, I'd have prisons overflowing. I'd have judges promoting pornography. Soon, I would evict God from the courthouse, then from the schoolhouse, and then from the houses of Congress. And in his churches, I would substitute psychology for religion and deify science. I would lure priests and pastors into misusing boys and girls and church money. If I were the devil, I'd make the symbols of Easter an egg and the symbols of Christmas a bottle. If I were the devil, I would take from those who have and give to those who want until I have killed the incentive of ambition. What do you bet? I could get whole states to promote gambling as a way to get rich. I would caution against extremes in hard work and patriotism in moral conduct. I would convince the young that marriage is old-fashioned, that swinging is more fun, that what you see on TV is the way to be, and thus I would undress you in public, and I could lure you into bed with diseases for which there is no cure. In other words, if I were the devil, I'd just keep right on doing what he's doing. From Paul Harvey, Good Day. And what's amazing about this, this was back in 1965, and how much of this is true today, and it may be even worse than what was in the story. I guess we need a Paul Harvey in our lives today that we could listen to daily, maybe talk some sense into a lot of us. Today we're going to look at a story from biohistory.org. Calamity Jane, Heroine of the West or an Ordinary Woman, by Rebecca Hine. Calamity Jane's life is two stories, the facts of her biography and the nearly parallel rise of the romantic tales that today comprise the Calamity Jane legend. With Martha Carnari, gun-toting, hard-drinking, swashbuckling female who could drive a mule team and fight Indians like a man? Or was she an alcoholic prostitute stuck in poverty and forced to labor at menial jobs in life both dreary and mundane? The truth probably lies somewhere in between. James McLeod in Calamity Jane, the Woman in the Legend, comments that Martha Carnari was an ordinary woman of her time, with little in her life or behavior that would merit special interest. Yet certain notable traits reoccur in McLeod's account. Uncommon generosity, most often in helping sick or injured people, and a spunky spirit shown in her greeting to her friends, especially after a long absence. The emergence of Calamity Jane's legend, fanciful tales such as her role as professional scout for General George Crook and others, or her supposed close relationship with Wild Bill Hickok, probably inflated the true tales of her generosity and spirited behavior. Disentangling fact from myth is the heart of McLeod's biography. He notes that since Carnari was illiterate and left no correspondence, documentation is mostly limited to contemporary newspaper accounts, reminiscence by acquaintances and witnesses, whether reliable or not, and a few legal documents, mostly county records and census figures. After a rise to celebrity, she published a booklet, The Life and Adventures of Calamity Jane, by herself, most likely with the help of a ghostwriter. McLeod notes that while this short account generally follows a historic record of events in the West during her lifetime, Calamity Jane, while sometimes telling the truth, also exaggerated and distorted her role in many of these events. This further confuses the trail, creating a string of documented facts connected only by the best available information. A census taken in Mercer County, Missouri, reports that in 1860, Robert and Charlotte Carnari, living near Princeton and probably farming, had three children. Martha, aged 4, was the oldest, so she was born sometime in 1856, possibly on May 1st, as she claims in her Life and Adventures. The next documented fact, in 1869, the census taken in Carter, now Sweetwater County, Wyoming Territory, places Martha in Piedmont, a small Union Pacific town, now a ghost town 20 miles from the Utah line near present-day Evanston. This census correctly lists her birthplace as Missouri, but reports her at the age of 15. She was actually 13, and there is no mention of her parents. Martha was almost certainly orphaned, sometimes between 1866 and 67. In her Life and Adventures, she reports, Mother died at Blackfoot, Montana, 1866. I left Montana in the spring of 1866 for Utah. Remained in Utah until 1867, where my father died. Since her narrative correctly places her in Piedmont, sometime after that, McLeod comments, if there are any doubts that Martha's life and adventure include some reliable information, they should be stifled by the Carter County Census. From this point, McLeod explains, no contemporary documents exist to confirm or deny stories about the next 5 years. In the Life and Adventures, after mentioning her residence in Piedmont, she claims to have visited Fort Russell near Cheyenne in 1870, where she would have been 14, and Fort Sanders near Laramie, Wyoming in 1872. Calamity Jane first drew attention of the press in 1875 at the age of 19, when she accompanied the Jenny expedition from Fort Laramie, Wyoming to the southern Black Hills. The U.S. government had commissioned this expedition, sending geologist Walter P. Jenny and Henry Newton to investigate the mineral resources in the Black Hills. The year after Custer and 1,000 troops had found gold there, and pressure was building fast to take the land away from the Sioux, J.K. Lane, acting assistant surgeon for the expedition, was also a correspondent for the Chicago Daily Tribune. Lane's June 19, 1875 article, The Gold Hunters, confirms Calamity Jane's presence with the expedition. His piece is also the first contemporary report identifying her soon-to-be-famous nickname. Lane notes, Colum is dressed in a suit of soldier blue and straddles a mule equal to the professional black snake swingers in the Army. After returning to Laramie, probably with a supply train, Calamity Jane next accompanied General George Crook on his 1876 expeditions into northern Wyoming territories to attack the Cheyenne and the Sioux. Regarding the enduring myth that Calamity Jane was a scout for Crook and others, Captain Jack Crawford, in March 5th of 1904, article for the Journalist, explains that he was well acquainted with every scout employed by the government. Calamity Jane was never employed as a scout by General Crook, who gave her no recognition whatsoever except to order her out of camp when he discovered she was a camp follower, by which Crawford almost certainly meant to imply that she was a prostitute. In June of 1876, Calamity Jane rode into Deadwood, Dakota Territories with James Butler Hickok, Wild Bill, in a conspicuous parade down the main street of the town. This episode began to rise to national fame. Here are two stories illustrating her flair for life and her generosity, surfaced from her time in and around Deadwood in the summer and fall of 1876. At a reception for General Crook, who traveled to the Black Hills in early September after his defeat at the Battle of Rosebud, Dr. Valentine McGillicuddy, medical officer with Crook's Army, reported that he danced with Calamity Jane. They cavorted through the half-drunken mob. Calamity shrieked at old pals and slapped them on the back as they passed. Later that fall, a miner named Jack McCartney broke his leg. He lived alone in an isolated cabin between Central City and Lead, South Dakota, and was unable to care for himself. Calamity Jane, then only 20, heard the story, raised money by asking for checks instead of drinks at the dance hall she frequented, then purchased supplies and engaged a packer at Deadwood. Arriving at McCarthy's cabin around Thanksgiving, she cared for him there. McLaird comments that this story may be true, adding that Calamity's flamboyant behavior, probably referring to her dance with McGillicuddy, as well as her habit of dressing as a soldier or a scout, and thereby fooling some of the men in the Jenny and Crook expeditions, made it possible for newspapers to ignore her. She made a good copy. On October 15th of 1877, Calamity was featured heroine in Edward Wheeler's dime novel, Deadwood Dick, the Prince of the Road, or The Black Rider of the Black Hills. This fictitious portrayal of Calamity Jane catapulted her into the public eye. Fantastic stories proliferated, but no doubt inspired by the dime novel episodes. These rumors, including her unerring aim with a gun or ox whip, fighting Indians and scaling cliffs. Meanwhile, the real Calamity Jane continued her ordinary existence, living in the Dakota Territories from 1878 to 1881 and in the Montana Territory until the late 1884s. In November of that year, Calamity returned to the area that is now Wyoming, where she remained for the next 10 years, mostly in the western part. During this decade, she married William Steers and also had a daughter, Jessie, born possibly in Lander on October 28th of 1887. According to McLaird, her marriage to Steers is documented by a certificate of marriage in the Bingham County, Idaho Territory, dated May 30th of 1888. Calamity also claimed as husbands, or by her name, was associated with Clinton Burke and a man named Corning, and possibly King. Neither relationship appears to have lasted, although the life and adventure is authored by Mrs. M. Burke. Most of the newspaper reports about her during her decade in Wyoming focuses on one of two themes, drunk and disorderly, or Calamity Jane's tall tales told by herself. An example of the latter is in the Cheyenne Daily Leader on June 21st of 1887, which refers her as both Calamity Jane and Mary Jane Steers, and quotes her story, "At Bismarck, I was courted by a pretty little army officer who challenged another officer who spoke to me to fight a duel. Amit was gaining ground, directing the final 9 years of her life towards the promotion of the life and adventure, selling photographs of herself and appearing in the Wild West shows. Calamity apparently visited Yellowstone Park several times to sell her promotional material to the tourists. Will Frackleton, in his 1941 memoir, Sagebrush Dentist, told of her first visit to his dental office in Sheridan, Wyoming, adding, "I saw Calamity again in 1897 when I took a pack trip to Yellowstone Park. She was dressed in men's clothes and seemed a little older and much grayer. When Calamity learned that her pack horses were missing, she swore a blue streak." Calamity continued to exploit her increasing fame, appearing in the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York. In the summer of 1901, while in Buffalo, she encountered a friend, Wirt Newcomb, a Montana cowboy visiting the exposition with his Eastern relatives. When Martha saw Newcomb, after a performance, she yelled, "Slim, old Slim from Mile City, damn my skin if it ain't." Newcomb stopped the flood of happy profanity, explaining that his relatives were churchgoers. Then he introduced them. "Never was I more amazed at a change in front of a person. Never could you imagine it could be the same person. She was as polite as one of the party and entertained them all royalty for 15 or 20 minutes." After returning to South Dakota in November of 1901 and spending some time in Montana as well, Calamity died 2 years later in Terry, South Dakota on August 1st of 1903. She was 47. Heroic myths about Calamity Jane are so interwoven with her truer accounts of her generosity, audacity, and high spirits that all stories of her life merit close examination. Yet one thing that seems certain, though Calamity Jane had an ordinary life, even sad life, dogged by drinking problems which almost certainly killed her, she was kind to friends and strangers alike, and her daring behavior, such as disguising herself as a man on a military and scientific expedition, was an unusual woman for her time. Thanks for joining us today, and we hope you enjoy our podcast. As per the code of the West, we ride for the brand, and we ride for Wyoming.